Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of January 15th, 2019. Governor Henry McMaster was sworn into his first full term as governor last week and laid out his vision for the next 4 years. The Post and Courier's Andy Shane and Matt Kennard with the Associated Press join me to look at what McMaster's plan is, the reaction to his speech, and what we can expect from his upcoming budget and State of the State address. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who write the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections while you test the limits of bottomless mimosas. Hey there, weekend listeners. Or instead of liking an egg on Instagram to crush Kylie Jenner's Instagram record. I don't really get it, but I'm glad you're doing it. You know, we're not biased here on The Lead, but we do have a slant against the Kardashians. Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that a deal to complete Interstate 526 over Johns and James Islands could be back on track after years of tumult. The State Transportation Infrastructure Bank approved the $725 million project on January 10th. Now, the Charleston County Council voted the same day to approve the contract, which will require it to contribute around $300 million to the project, which will primarily come from the county's penny sales tax. Number two, the Associated Press reports that a federal court hearing will go forward as scheduled in Reno on the state's attempt to block the Energy Department's plans to ship plutonium from South Carolina to Nevada. The state of Nevada filed suit November 30th, accusing the Department of Energy of failing to properly study the environmental threats posed by moving about 2,200 pounds of weapons-grade plutonium from the Savannah River Nuclear Weapons Refining Complex to the nation's former nuclear proving grounds north of Las Vegas by January 1st, 2020. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that more South Carolinians than ever used the federal exchanges last year to sign up for 2019 health insurance, even as the Affordable Care Act weathered attacks and the number of people buying plans for themselves across the country declined. The South Carolina Department of Insurance numbers show that 203,402 people in South Carolina enrolled and paid for a health insurance plan, about 4,300 more than last year. Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina is the only insurer selling plans throughout the state. Now, this year was also the first time there was no rule in place requiring people to sign up for health insurance or pay a penalty. The entire law was recently thrown into doubt when a federal judge in Texas ruled it was unconstitutional. That ruling is under appeal. And number four, a bill limiting the governor's ability to make recess appointments sped through the Senate last week. S1 would limit the governor's ability to make appointments without the Senate's approval, like McMaster did months ago when he put Charlie Condon as the head of Santee Cooper's board without the Senate's consideration. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of McMaster's move, but lawmakers could soon prevent that. The bill gets to the House this week. And now for a bumpy bonus quorum call. Do you know of some troublesome potholes around you? Well, the SCDOT wants to hear from you. The transportation agency launched a pothole blitz. Check out their website, scdot.org, to report a troublesome pothole. And like the Saints did to AT's Eagles fans' heart, we've buried the lead.
That's too soon, Gavin.
Is it?
It's too soon. Too soon.
Well, Governor Henry McMaster was sworn into his first full term in office on a crisp and sunny January 9th before a crowd of thousands outside of the State House. He laid out his vision for the next 4 years with economic development, education reform, and environmental protections at its core. To talk about all that, I'm joined with the Post and Courier's Columbia Bureau Chief Andy Shane and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard to analyze McMaster's speech and to handicap his forthcoming executive budget and the State of the State address. Welcome to you both.
Hello, good to be back.
Good to be back, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year. Andy, it's been a busy month for McMaster. Like I said, he's going to release his budget shortly, and then, of course, a major State of the State address. But just looking at the inaugural speech that we heard last week, was this the same Henry we've been hearing for decades, or is this someone who's coming into his own, who has full ownership of these first, you know, these 4 years going forward? What did we see from McMaster?
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned these first 4 years that he's going to own. I mean, he has been wanting this job for 30 years. And he has finally, let alone he got it, of course, 2 years ago through a promotion when Nikki Haley became UN ambassador. Henry was lieutenant governor and earned it. But now he's earned it. He was elected. The people put him into office. So he's now had the formal inauguration on the south side of the State House, all the bells and whistles that go with it. And I think his address sort of said, I'm here. This is what I'm going to be doing. This is what my vision is. And of course, it kind of sounded like his campaign. Mm-hmm. South Carolina is winning. You didn't want to change the coach. I'm a veteran coach and someone who can take you to the touchdown or to the field goal or whatever it is you're going to do, whatever sports metaphor. There were a lot of them during the inauguration speech. And of course, he made the core of it economic prosperity for the state, continuing the economic boom that we have been seeing sort of post-recession, helping the rural areas, and most importantly, helping education K-12 was a big theme. He has been talking with legislators about this, so I think he's trying to dovetail what his ideas are with what the legislature plans on doing. And I think he also talked a lot about also working with the legislature. Mm-hmm. The past two governors we've had have made sort of a business, made sport, continuing the analogies, of fighting the legislature, Sanford and Nikki Haley. And so I think Governor McMaster wanted to lay out a plan that said, I'm going to work with these folks and get done what I think ought to get done.
So you'd be able to accomplish a lot of those goals, Meg. I mean, we'll go through them a little bit, but just, you know, looking at the top one, education reform, he was saying a lot of different things out there, you know, reforming teacher pay and changing classroom regulations so they can work better. Are we going to see some of that be able to be accomplished, I guess?
It all depends on his relationship with the legislature, mm-hmm. which, as we've talked about here before, governors come in and have all kinds of great ideas and plans. And during the campaign, we heard a ton of that from candidates on both sides. I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to implement these plans. But in South Carolina, the governor can't do that. He or she has to work really closely with the legislature, all being on the same page to accomplish broad-based reform in any area. So at least McMaster is starting off on a good foot in terms of the possibility of education reform, because leaders in both parties in the legislature in both chambers have said that is something that they're really wanting to work on this year. But they've all also acknowledged that is a big issue, and it's not really super possible to get a ton done in one session. Maybe two, maybe the full two-year span of this session that we have going on. Maybe there will be something big to come out of that. So the possibility is fairly decent that at least the governor can work, you know, maybe with the legislature to accomplish some of that if they maintain good relations.
And speaking of sports metaphors and the legislature, I'm going to just read part of that last part of his speech, which was to the members of the General Assembly. We among ourselves are not competitors. We are on the same team with the same ultimate goal, which is the prosperity and happiness of the people of South Carolina. So that kind of goes back to what we're talking about here, not just the sports metaphors, but, you know, really kind of coming together. And we heard that from lawmakers saying that there is a relationship there and they can kind of go to him and you know, there's a little bit more of a give and take there. But kind of talking about his education reform package, and he had a really big line that really stood out to a lot of people, and that was, my pledge to you today is that the words corridor of shame will soon be a fading memory. And he said that will require state-backed economic development, commitment to bring jobs to these communities by providing infrastructure in rural areas, not only water and sewer and roads, but in school buildings and facilities. Andy, that kind of made me think a little bit back to the debates between McMaster and the Democratic gubernatorial candidate James Smith, when they were talking about how do you get these rural communities to kind of get lifted up, to get to be more attractive. And McMaster was always saying, you know, you bring in a big factory, you get these jobs in here. He talks about, you know, these people saying this to him on the campaign trail.
He sees,
but there's a lot more to do it. Like, you know, and then James Smith countered saying, no, you need this, you need that. So it's that chicken and egg situation. It seems like he's kind of adapting some of that into speech.
Yeah, it is, and I mean, what he is essentially seeing is that if we are able to boost education, especially in the rural areas, that'll make it more attractive for these smaller, you know, economic development projects, 100, 200, 500 jobs. You know, we're not talking about a BMW or a Volvo, but maybe we're talking about, you know, like a chicken plant or a, you know, a small manufacturing plant. And again, they'll be able to find qualified workers within those rural areas, and so it's a win-win. The businesses, of course, get a ready-made workforce, and then you also get a workforce ready to make money, essentially. You know, it's one of the things I thought was interesting about his line about that the corridor of shame is going to be history is that smells like a read my lips, no new taxes kind of line, that if unless he can get things done with the legislature, are going to come back and we're going to, you know, the media, the public, school teachers, everybody is going to come back and remind him of this. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a very bold statement for him to put out there. He normally doesn't do that kind of thing, but I think that's how important he sees this issue.
One of the other things he hit on that touches both on education as well as economic development is the importance of a skilled workforce. That's something that came up a lot during the gubernatorial campaign. Lieutenant Governor Pamela Evatt spent a lot of time going around. I spent a whole day with her where we went to technical schools, colleges, manufacturers, meeting with the people who are directly affected by increases in training for skilled workers. As Andy was just saying, those are the kind of workers that even the smallest economic development project in the manufacturing sector is going to need anywhere in South Carolina. So, again, this all kind of goes into the same theme, which was, you know, the governor's whole talk about prosperity and winning and maintaining South Carolina's forward momentum. Maintaining a skilled workforce is going to be a big part of that to boost education, to boost our economy, to boost basically everything that we've got going on. And that was something that he hit on a lot.
And another thing we saw, you know, we were talking about this investment in infrastructure, specifically in education. But McMaster also said that, you know, just because we have a budget surplus in South Carolina, you know, that extra $1 billion of extra spending that we can use, lawmakers can use this year, doesn't mean we need to spend it all at once and that we can return some of that to taxpayers. Andy, is it difficult to say we'll give some money back, but hey, we also need to pour in millions of dollars into fixing a lot of these problems?
And there you've raised the billion-dollar question.
Yeah, there we
actually
go.
The $9 billion question, I mean, which is he wants to give money back to taxpayers, he wants a tax cut, but at the same time, we have to pay billions and millions into these schools. And so how do you do that? Of the $1 billion, about half of it is recurring, which means it's now baked in year after year, and half of which is one time, which may be next year it gets put in, but we don't know. It just depends how the, of course, how tax collections go and how the economy continues, you know, through 2019. So I think what you're going to see is some stopgap measures this year on education and on some other issues. Let's get some money for teachers. Let's get some money in for technology improvements, but not the whole big enchilada, you know, as
funding reform.
Tackling the funding system.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we're at the beginning of a 2-year session. So I think year one is kind of a warm up. And then year two is when, you know, next year in 2020 is when you kind of slam it home. So I think what we're going to see is sort of a couple of first steps out of this and then see where the money is and go from there. But at the same time, if he can find a way to cut taxes and to return some of it to the folks like he promised during the campaign, he's going to try to do that.
And even some of those small measures, if you can get those done in the first year, that will curry good favor going into the second year, where the debate on the bigger issues like the funding formula will be very tough, very contentious. Even though everybody says, yes, we would like to get education into a better state of affairs, that doesn't mean they agree on how to do that. So that is going to be the protracted, prolonged battle. But with a few positive moves in the first year, that may bode better for chances at bigger reforms the second year.
And the other thing I think they're going to tackle this year is going to be reforming the school districts and the school boards, which, of course, doesn't necessarily cost any money, but is a huge issue. And what they want to really be able to do is to hold the school boards especially accountable for what happens in districts that are struggling with finances and with test scores. So I think you're going to see a little bit of that. And as I said, that's not a money issue.
And that's something that House Majority Leader Gary Simrell has already told me that he is very much on board with. I had a conversation with him about where he saw this session going, and specifically district-level reform is something that he mentioned. So I would imagine that we're going to see some movement toward that for sure.
It's going to be a lot of local versus state feuding there too, but I do remember during that speech, you know, he did say consolidating school districts and giving our state superintendent the authority to remove and replace non-productive school boards. Where I was standing in the audience, I mean, I still heard a very large applause for that line. So it seems like there's a lot of traction there. And again, going back to how we're going to see spending going forward, the governor will unveil his executive budget soon, possibly even this week. And that will kind of outline how some of that money gets spent.
About the time that this podcast drops, we should be hearing it.
So we'll see how he plans to either rebate some money and also spend some money. But Meg, I want to talk a little bit more, just we're kind of wrapping up here, about what we heard in the speech. Obviously, economic development, we touched on education reform. But another issue that McMaster continues to harp on is the state's environment and how important it is for our economy. At one point, he said our economic growth and the preservation of our natural environment are not opposing objectives, which must be balanced as in a competition one against the other, and so they're complementary. So obviously, it's talking about offshore drilling, and we've seen a lot of movement forward and backward on that. What did you take away from that and in light of the current situation with the federal government?
That portion of McMaster's speech was a not-so-veiled reference to what's going on with drilling and his difference of opinion with President Donald Trump, who is an ally of his but with whom he disagrees on behalf of South Carolina about pursuing offshore drilling off the Atlantic coastline. And the piece that really stood out to me on that front was the governor saying, "Let me assure you, I will firmly stand against all efforts to endanger the future of our pristine coastline." You can't say it much more plainly than that. Our state is now officially a part of have a lawsuit against the federal government encouraging, urging, however, whatever verbiage you want to use, them to not pursue drilling off our coastline. And that was our governor letting the people know, even though he does have a strong relationship with Donald Trump, he is standing up for them. They have told him, we do not want to drill off the coast. And he is letting them know he's listening. So that was an important marker. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how the lawsuit goes. We'll see how the administration's plans for drilling go. There's nothing actually happening right now, but it is a five-year plan to expand off the Atlantic coastline. So that will be an important issue to track and to see if the governor will continue to leverage his relationship with Washington in terms of standing up on issues with which, you know, he disagrees, the president, and other things like that. And it was an important, very much toward the end of his speech, to put it in there and say, look, I've heard you, and here's how I feel about it.
Though he never said the word drilling.
No, he didn't.
It was interesting. He talked broadly, and I feel like it was, you know, not having knowledge, I felt it was in there. But if I didn't have knowledge, I didn't hear it directly.
Right, and that's why when I wrote the story about this, I said veiled, because he wasn't overt about it. He did talk about the Floodwater Commission, something he got started, which is obviously a big issue as well. But he didn't talk explicitly about drilling, that's for sure.
And maybe that is kind of going back to it being a balancing act between Washington and the relationships we have there versus, you know, environmentalists in the state. And, of course, you know, he did mention that also last year in the State of the State address, too, without the pristine the coastline, too. So I'm guessing, you know, looking forward, Andy, can we expect some more of this in the State of the State? Do we just hear a mini version of State of the State? Or what can we expect to hear next week when we
Well, I think State of the State will be, obviously, there'll be a tinge of whatever he has in the executive budget, with the specifics of what he has suggested to the legislature on what their priorities should be. So if he's got something specific in the way of a teacher raise or of any sort of funding for technology or reform, he'll bring up that's more specific. This was, you know, the inauguration speech was more of a 30,000 foot. Let me give you sort of an idea of my vision of the state through a lot of sports metaphors. At the same time, you know, the State of the State will be more nitty gritty on these things. You know, it's, you know, obviously rare that he gets this sort of these two speeches sort of back to back. You know, more normally, obviously, it's just State of the State. But obviously, every 4 years, he gets a chance to do a twofer. So that's what I expect is more specifics on what he brought up about the environment, about education, and about economic development.
Meg, any prediction there on what we might see?
Similar to Andy, in the State of the State, the governor is going to be talking about specifics with the legislators. You know, he's talking to all of us, but he's in their chamber really talking to them. And whether it's education or tax reform or some of the other things that are on his agenda to accomplish for this next year, he is going to be mentioning some specific things that he is going to be looking toward them to work with them, since they're the ones who will legislatively be carrying out whatever his ideas are.
And it's no longer a pseudo-campaign speech. You know, he's not running for anything next year, so he can actually get more direct with them about what he wants to see going forward. So it should be interesting to see, again, not as much lofty rhetoric per se as we saw in the inauguration speech, but obviously some more specifics.
He won't be on the ballot, but all of them will be in 2020.
Which actually we'll probably talk in a subsequent episode about just how that will affect education funding, changing that.
Well, and then the other thing you hate to say is that Henry's going to be running for another term. Re-election starts now.
Yeah.
Everything's on the board. And that's where you go back to that line about the corridor of shame. I can imagine in 4 years when he's running for re-election, the Democrats saying, where are we on that corridor of shame, sir? You know, and so they, I mean, so as I said, I think the re-election campaign started.
Since that is a kind of a figurehead position in South Carolina, that you're the governor, you can only really do so much from where you are, use the bully pulpit. What would a realistic success for McMaster look like? Is it something as easy as saying, look, I told you we'd have teacher pay raises. Now we got teacher pay raises. I can check that off. Or is it going to be more difficult for him since he did talk about getting rid of the corridor of shame and having to make that into a success? It seems like a pretty wide gamut, but could he say he had a success on education reform, you know, depending on if it's as small as a teacher pay raise, or does it have to be erasing the entire corridor of shame for it to be a success?
If there are small successes to which he could point toward that goal, I think that he certainly would claim success in some of those areas. Mm-hmm. Getting rid of the quote-unquote corridor of shame is obviously a huge task. There's a lot of moving parts that would involve something like that, and that is going to be difficult. There's very little, as we've mentioned, the governor can do by himself. Mm-hmm. But any effort in progress toward that overall goal, whether or not it actually implements the kind of substantive change that all of these lawmakers are talking about in the long run, in the short term, is something that he could leverage to voters, to other lawmakers trying to move toward that bigger solution, to say, look, I've been working on this. I have done all that I can. and I'm going to need your help to get it across the finish line. So, pardon the sports pun yet again, but at the end of it all, that is something that he could possibly take to the legislature to say, okay, mm-hmm. now to really get this done big term, you are going to have to help me more than you've been helping me so far.
And it could even be economic development growth along that corridor as well.
Well, and the other thing is, again, he's promised working with the legislature. And if he says, I have this plan, and he can't get this, and he can't get this plan over the goal line, mm-hmm. then you may sit here and say, okay, what happened to this whole idea that you have this relationship with these people that the other governors didn't? Mm-hmm. So that's where, again, it mm-hmm. might be a figurehead position, but again, if you're going to go ahead and work with the legislature and try to convince them that your priorities are the right priorities, that's going to be what voters are going to hold on him in 2022.
And I think it's going to be probably looking at more of a unified education approach that, you know, I think most of this, majority of the items when it comes to education reform, people are on the same page with. It's going to be a lot of those little detail parts, is moving parts of the funding and how, you know, local versus state comes into play and all those other factors come into play. That's probably where we're going to see more divisiveness. And that might be something we've talked about, could be more of a second year situation in terms of, instead of this year. So we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
It sounds great. Who doesn't want to improve education? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like helping sick children. It's an issue around which everybody can rally. But the specifics of getting that done vary a lot, party to party, politician to politician, and chamber to chamber.
Yeah.
So absolutely,
and
right.
171 ideas up there, you know, including the governor there.
Well, and it's also, who do you make happy and who do you make mad? I mean, because mm-hmm. in the end, he's not probably going to do enough tax cutting for the folks who want lower taxes, and he's probably not going to do enough for education, for the education advocate. So the idea is, can he get half the way there on each of those, or two-thirds of the way on one and a third on the way on the other? I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. but in the end, he's got this balancing act that he's going to be held accountable for.
Plenty to watch for, especially going forward, as education remains a top priority for not only the governor but lawmakers here in Columbia. Thanks again to Meg Kennard with the Associated Press and Andy Shane with the Post and Courier.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, campaign trail life in 2019 will focus a good bit on the upcoming 2020 Democratic presidential primary, since South Carolina is an early primary state. So expect a lot of contenders to be popping up and a lot of news regarding that in the coming days and weeks. But I know we just got finished with an election, but guess what, guys? The campaign trail is endless. It's a never-ending story. It's basically like Jumanji. We're stuck here until the next one. But to help break that up a little bit, the campaign trail will also feature some more tidbits from South Carolina's congressional delegation. So starting off, Andy Shane reports that Republican Governor Henry McMaster loaned his campaign $100,000 in the week before the November election, despite raising a near-record amount of money to seal his win over Democrat James Smith. Overall, McMaster, who benefited from the backing of President Donald Trump, raised nearly $8.1 million to Smith's $3.2 million during the campaign. Also, the governor's race was the most expensive in South Carolina's history. After competitive primaries for both parties, candidates spent a total of $21.5 million. That's a lot of pimento cheese where I come from. Shifting gears to the congressional delegation, 1st Congressional District Representative Joe Cunningham was stopped last week from walking onto the House floor with a six-pack of beer from local Lowcountry breweries. Yeah, guys, beer. Cunningham tweeted about his misadventure of attempting to bring the local beers to Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon. Senator Lindsey Graham has officially become the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and will oversee hearings of William Barr, the nominee to be President Donald Trump's new attorney general this week. In shutdown news, Graham has shifted his stance on the shutdown, going from digging in to saying on Fox News Sunday that President Trump should reopen the government for 3 weeks under a short-term spending bill as negotiations continue. Now, should a border security deal not be reached, Graham would recommend a state of emergency after that. However, Trump rejected Graham's proposal on Monday. As of this taping, the federal government entered its 24th day of the shutdown, the longest in U.S. history. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with more state trivia? Well, he is. So let's get right into it, Russ. What you got for me?
Well, a lot of celebration last week about a new governor, the inauguration for Governor McMaster. But did you know, like the federal government, there is a mechanism in the state constitution for the removal of the governor, if necessary, if it's deemed that the governor is unable to carry out his business, is sick, out of the state for extended periods of time, or things like that. And it's somewhat complicated. The way it would work is if a majority of the attorney general, the state treasurer, the comptroller general, and the secretary of state, if three of those four, put in writing to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate that they feel the governor is not fit to serve at that time. That's the way it would work. Now, the governor can respond to that, and if the guy, if he or she decides, I disagree, I'm certainly able to continue to serve, then that's it. Unless the same majority of the four constitutional officers, the treasurer, the attorney general, secretary of state, and comptroller general, a second time put in writing that the governor should not be serving in office. The governor has the ability again to dispute that. And if it's disputed twice, who decides whether the governor should remain in office?
I have an idea, but yeah, this is interesting. I did not know the intricacies of this. Okay, what are the choices here, Russ?
A, the General Assembly. B, the State Supreme Court. C, the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. D, none of the above.
Oh, God. None of the above is always the answer. We know that. But, gosh, I was thinking Supreme Court, and then Chief of the Supreme Court sounds... Oh, Russ, this is something. I kind of have to go with none of the above. I'm not going yet, but none of the above. We always say, we always take that one. That's kind of like our nuclear option here. But I feel like maybe, because when you said General Assembly, I want it to be like two-thirds of the General Assembly. I think that would have been more of the specific answer for General Assembly. So that's kind of why I'm not really thinking about them. Or maybe it's even the Senate or, you know, the House. Who knows what it could be. Supreme Court would be pretty broad. And if we're talking about individual cabinet officers, I feel like they wouldn't have a majority of the Supreme Court. Chief Justice, I really want it to be that. But I also can't go back on my rule of none of the above. Usually it's all the above we say. But anytime there's that all the, none of the... Okay, I will say D, but I want to also say that I would also go with the Chief Justice. So what's the answer there?
Well, the correct answer is A, the General Assembly.
Oh, my gosh.
If the General Assembly is not in session, when all this, the uproar would occur, they are required to come to Columbia and convene within 48 hours and vote.
We've never had that happen, obviously.
Not that I'm aware of. Actually, was talking about that with Walter Edgar. He said he was not aware that that had ever occurred in state history. Now, to complicate things more, the General Assembly could, on its own, do a very similar thing. If they by two-thirds vote, made that decision. Of course, the governor would still have the opportunity to, that basically would be pretty much like an impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Well, Russ, now we know, and according to his relationship with his cabinet officers and the lawmakers, I think we won't see that happening, at least as we can see it right now.
Let's hope not.
Well, thanks, Russ. We appreciate it.
Sure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLEDEPOD. You can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDPOD. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. And on a sad note, a forlorn farewell to our social media strategist, Caitlin Park, who is heading on to greener pastures. We'll miss your laughs, your dank memes, and your shawls the most. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on January 14th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. As one of our greatest presidents once said, get off my plane.
That's a lot of pimento cheese where I come from.